Well, over on the left.
Go to YouTube. Search for Iraq Afghanistan combat footage. You'll get lots of hits. Veterans Day is coming up.
All right, go.
This is Hearing Voices from NPR with a Veterans Hour. Voices of our armed forces, men and women, who served in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Here, the house is surrounded.
How do they do it? Fight and kill and risk their lives.
What happened? What hit me at? Got me in my face.
Some don't even agree with the why, but still they're willing to be the how.
I think it's very important to have primary sources, first-hand accounts of people who participated in events.
Stand by for another frag.
That writing helps establish a broader view that can make for better decision-making in the future.
Sergeant Helen Gearhart, Missouri Army National Guard.
I've taken an oath to serve officials elected by the American people. The people, they are my boss. And I have surrendered the force that I carry in terms of the weapon to those elected officials. So I have to hope that the American people will educate themselves enough so that they can choose people who will do a good job, people who will really pay attention to the information that they're receiving.
Hey, we got him! How you know?
You hear?
Watch your face, man.
Room, we got way too many rooms on our right and left.
You hear something? Back me up, Matt. Back me up.
Allahu Akbar! Allahu Akbar! Allahu Akbar! Allahu Akbar!
Hey, come out! Come out!
Yalla!
My name is John McCary. I was a sergeant in the United States Army. I was a 97 Echo Arabic interrogator, human intelligence collector. Combat operations occur, and then they bring back detainees or prisoners or whatever you want to call them, and then I talk to them in an office somewhere on base. The reality of the fact is when you speak Arabic, and then I ended up picking up Iraqi dialect, you become the interface for dealing with the local population, which is 99.9% of your work in a counterinsurgency, because you're dealing with a full-blown civil society in Iraq. A counterinsurgency is in the middle of a living, breathing country into which you've inserted a full-blown military operation. And so I ended up doing everything from negotiating with the local politicians to meeting with tribal elders to talking with religious leaders about the social and moral impact of our operations and the insurgency and the local population's role in all of that. And I have to give credit to the command for pushing me forward right from the start to get out there and see what our operations do to people and how they are presented and the effect that they have. That's really paramount. That has to be your first consideration. It almost comes before your efficacy. Is it what impact will this have on the people that are around us? Because that's what it's all about. You're trying to reshape society with a military operation. I mean, that's a little bit of a square peg in a round hole. So my job ended up really being to talk to people.
And that was Sergeants Helen Gearhart and John McCary. The music is Japan Cakes, their song Behind the Mountains. And this is U.S. and Iraqi Special Operations Forces in combat, Sadr City, Baghdad. It's from a U.S. Army video by Staff Sergeant Ryan C. Creel.
Group.
I'm Barrett Golding of Hearing Voices. In 2007, I spent a day with some wounded warriors fly fishing on the Rose River in Virginia. Many were amputees. All were part of Project Healing Waters.
I'm First Lieutenant Avon Forsyth, Airborne Infantry Platoon Leader. Project Healing Waters is a program that was started by Captain Ed Nicholson. Basically, what we do is provide emotional and physical therapy to wounded warriors of every service and every conflict through the skills of fly fishing and fly tying. And just to see the changes in these wounded service members emotionally when you get them out here in beautiful water like this, or we go on these trips. You know, when you go from lying in a hospital bed hooked up to pumps and machines, and you got people poking you and prodding you and feeding you all kinds of medications, and you're in the most severe pain you've ever been in your entire life, to get out here is like being reborn. Because right now, you know, you've got over 18,000 severely wounded from the global war on terrorism. The focus right now is on Afghanistan and Iraq, but we've actually got a gentleman here today that lost both his legs in Vietnam. So what we're trying to do is get everybody that needs this program, surviving from World War II all the way to now. There's a lot more people out there that need help. My injury is permanent disability. It's a paralysis of the right hand and very limited motion of the right elbow. I was with the 82nd Airborne when I got hit. In Mosul, Iraq, on 4 January 05, my convoy was struck by an IED. Basically, it was an artillery round that was placed inside a taxi cab that was parked on the side of the road in a traffic circle. And so as my convoy came around that traffic circle, it was command detonated, probably with either a cell phone or a garage door open or anything that has an FM frequency. My gunner and I were hit in... We were put in a truck. My guys stayed there to fight it out with the insurgents. And, usually what happens is that an IED is used to initiate an ambush. And so as soon as they hit us with the shock of the IED, then they start shooting. But, you know, my guys, I mean, everybody in my battalion, 82nd, they're so very well trained and used to reacting to contact that as soon as they started taking fire, they rocked right back, started shooting up the insurgents. And then I was put in another vehicle, my gunner and I, and rushed to the combat support hospital. I didn't realize how bad it was because I couldn't see underneath, but it had taken nearly all the soft tissue from underneath my arm, exposing my bones. So it took muscle and tissue, and it took my median ulnar nerves with it. Unfortunately, that's why my right hand is paralyzed. Being a platoon leader, being an officer, being an infantryman, I'm so used to being able-bodied, being completely independent. In a matter of a split second, to become dependent, activities of daily living, they call them ADLs, those can be nearly impossible. I mean, you know, washing dishes, washing your clothes, bathing yourself can be an issue, you know, when you've got paralysis or an amputation or something like that. So I dropped into a very deep depression. You know, anger management issues, I was upset all the time. I had a very short fuse. It wouldn't take anything to set me off. I started to get apathetic. I thought, man, I just don't care. And when Ed came to me and said, hey, you know, I heard you're a fly fisherman, would you like to fish? I thought, nah, I'm really not interested. You know, I didn't want to go and make a fool of myself, and I didn't want to fail because I have this incredible fear of failure like most of us warriors do, you know. And it was my mom who said, you know, please, for me, just try it. And it also helped because Colonel Howard, the chief of OT at the time, was like, hey, LT, you will go out and do this. I thought, okay, so between him and my mom, I got out there on the water and just really... I slowly started to come around, and then pretty soon I thought, yeah, I can do this. I can do this. And then everybody that knows me and loves me just noticed a huge difference. And then when I started helping with this program, that became my mission. That's just kind of what I started living for, besides my family. So what's going to happen is eventually when all of us wounded service members are, when we're released from our recovery, we're going to be integrated into society, and you're going to start seeing us a lot more, especially because, there are a lot of us that are not letting it slow us down. So you're going to see us out doing adaptive sports and you're going to see us on the workforce and things like that. The one thing I'd say is don't be afraid of it. You know, don't be afraid of us. You know, don't be afraid to come up and say hello or ask what happened or anything like that. I mean, I think it's a very common reaction to see someone who's disabled, and then you kind of turn the other way because you don't want to think that they notice you. But we know you're looking. It doesn't hurt our feelings. Come over and ask what happened. You know, we'll tell you. These 18,000 plus service members that are severely wounded, they're not going to miraculously heal as soon as this war is over. You know, nobody's going to wave a magic wand and they're going to be able-bodied. some will get better, some will get worse. You know, so we'll need the support. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm Helen Gearhart. I was a specialist with the 1221st Transportation Company of the Missouri National Guard. We were in Iraq from June of 2003 to July of 2004. Dear friends and family, a few days ago I sat in the passenger seat of a truck with my M16 pointing out the window as I crossed the border into Iraq for the first time. All of us methodically scanned the landscape for the flesh-and-blood snipers or grenade launchers we had envisioned during training, and constantly glanced in the rearview mirror to make sure the truck behind us was at a safe distance. I felt greedy for every concrete detail to dispel the figments of the Iraq I had constructed in my own imagination over the months of waiting. Our convoy of 9 trucks and a Humvee felt very small to all of us. Our request for an MP escort had been denied without the required 48 hours notice, never mind that we'd been ordered onto the road with only about 36 hours warning. The MPs are stretched very thin, and though officially all convoys are supposed to be escorted, in reality most small groups go without. The first face I saw closely was a girl maybe 10 years old, thin but beating time on a half-full water bottle as she danced up and down on the shoulder of the road with confident grace. She looked straight into my eyes with no trace of humility. Her brilliant smile seemed to command acknowledgement of a beauty impossible to deny anything to. Her cinnamon and curry-colored gown waved like a flag of bold pleasure in her past triumphs. I wished I could throw roses and roast beef, confetti and corn dogs, wanted to celebrate her gutsy contrast to my worst fears and to get a good square meal into her belly. Behind her, an older woman stood still and straight, wrapped in black, staring through her daughter and me to the desert beyond. The next day, we were scheduled to pass through the outskirts of Baghdad, near where the members of another mission had seen the smoking remains of a 915 truck after it had been rocket grenaded. We took a wrong turn off the highway, and unable to read the Arabic street signs, wandered into the slums of Sadr City, where children pointed and laughed as our long convoy of illiterates passed back and forth through the narrow streets, looking for a way out. The adults barely glanced at us, faces surely schooled into stone by years of threats by those who held rifles and the keys to prisons that swallowed many sons, fathers, and husbands, whole without a word. People were amazingly, surprisingly friendly when we were first there. People running to the trucks, especially the children. The children are great barometers, really, of how the adults are feeling. The adult population had had years of training in a kind of neutrality of expression toward those in power. But where there was real support for us, the kids, they were very, very friendly when we were first there. As time went on and things were not going well, we saw a significant change, and especially after Abu Ghraib happened. People wouldn't even look at us.
Sergeant Gearhart's writings are part of the NEA book project, Operation Homecoming, Iraq, Afghanistan, in the words of U.S. troops. The guitar is by Jess Atkins. And you heard now Captain Avon Forsyth, U.S. Army, with Project Healing Waters. We're back now on the Rose River Farm in Virginia.
I'm Neil Frestaglia, Corporal, Infantry Mortarman. I'm just one of the normal guys out there running through the streets. So.
Okay, next cast. See that stick out in the water?
Mm-hmm.
Cast just to this end of the stick and let it sweep back a little bit further.
Okay. Down. I can just... I've got a few. Yeah, they're mostly 15 to probably about 18-inch rainbow. And all nice fish, good colors. I mean, a few of them had a pretty decent fight to them, so I don't know if how many people put their wheelchairs in water before just to catch fish, but I guess it worked for me, so hey, whatever. So
try that. Not small, but hopefully we'll catch a big fish.
Went to Iraq with 3rd Battalion, 7th Marines, and then I was in Ramadi until I got hurt, so. Like a lot of guys, IED blast. It was a large IED buried under some trash alongside the road. It was at night, actually, so there was no way at all we were actually going to see it. I was on foot. Blast came under the truck that we were standing next to and caught me in the legs. There are 7 of us injured. 5 of us are amputees. We have 1 leg in between the 5 of us. The others were just burn injuries and 1 KIA. He was one of my Marines. And I knew from the time of the blast that my legs were in trouble. If I lived, there was going to be some serious problems. A Navy corpsman who was in my platoon, he lost a leg about a month and a half beforehand. And I was the one who found him, and I put a tourniquet on his leg and carried him to a vehicle to get him out, evac'd. So I knew what could happen. And when I got hit, it really didn't surprise me when I woke up and found out, you know, how badly injured I was. You know, which is kind of odd to say, you know, kind of for someone who lost their legs. But it was hard. I mean, the first 3 weeks were really rough. But once I was able to get around and get into a wheelchair and start doing things on my own again, it got a lot easier. And, I mean, there's still days where you go, oh, you know, what the heck am I going to do for the rest of my life? But I have a pretty good plan set up, and just gotten married in September, and I actually want to be a high school science biology teacher. I want to go to school and start over where I ended my education 4+ years ago now. But there's going to be an influx of, you know, military amputees going out into the workforce and going to college, and I mean, there's already a lot of amputees out there. You know, I can tell when somebody's walking on a prosthetic leg. I've been around amputees for the last year. I don't think it'll ever be a common thing. At least I hope not. But already it's happening, and in the next few years there's going to be more out there. So, you know, just start over at life and see what happens.
That's the spot right there, right on that ledge.
Right over the ledge. It's 100 fish right here. So. They're hanging right underneath that stuff there.
See what we can do?
At this time, we the Black Lodge Singers would like to dedicate this veteran songs to all the veterans throughout the United States and Canada. And we certainly thank you for your services. Thank you.
RPG.
Those were the Black Lodge Singers from their Veterans Honor songs.
Okay, let's go.
Are you sick?
You okay?
Yeah, good.
Can't believe that guy's not dead.
These are Canadian troops from Alpha Company, 2nd Platoon in southern Afghanistan.
Change your mags! Change your mags!
Where are you guys up there? Grenade!
Grenade! Yeah.
Grenade!
Coming up, more from Operation Homecoming, more Project Healing Waters, the Farmer Veteran Coalition, and Iraq Veterans Against the War. That's in a minute on Hearing Voices.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
You are hearing voices of veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan. We're back on Virginia's Rose River with Project Healing Waters, teaching wounded warriors to fly fish.
That was really a beautiful fish.
Beautiful rainbow, beautiful color. Just like dancing with them, bringing them in, I just love it. Absolutely awesome. Any day you get near some water, get near the river is a good day.
I'm Sergeant First Class Eva Diane Cochran. I was injured in Kandahar, Afghanistan in 2004. I was in a Humvee. And, we rolled. I was told it was five times down a ravine, but I don't remember it. So, you know, adrenaline starts flowing, and you just want to keep on doing your mission and taking care of your soldiers. And I just kept saying, I'm okay, I'm okay, and I wasn't okay. So, I have spinal injuries. I had some fractures on my lower spine. I have a fused vertebrae in my neck and in my lower spine. So I had a lot of herniated disc and fractures.
Let's try it again here.
And on a good day when all my nerves are acting right, talking to my muscles real good, I can walk most of the day. Just I have to stop and rest. And a lot of times my back will start spasming, or my the nerves down my right leg won't work right. And then sounds weird, kind of lose the use of this leg and coordination, and then I'll fall. So I have a cane, and this is an improvement. This time last year I was on two crutches, and now I'm allowed to just have one cane. So
okay, girl, it's all yours.
Okay, I'll see what I can do.
Hey,
oh, he's thinking about it. No, I don't see him. Do you see him?
I think he took it once. There he is.
Strike it. Oh, he thought about it. I enlisted in the Army when I was 17, and that was a number of years ago. I think a lot of people think it's about going out and shooting people, and that's not what the military is about. That's not what it's about at all. America is just a great nation, and part of being a great nation is a responsibility to help those who can't help themselves. And it's not, you know, soldiers don't want war, but they train for it, and they don't run from it. And the Army's been very good to me. I've been in for almost 26 years now. I've done some amazing things. You know, I've flown to countries most people only dream about. I get paid to skydive out of a Black Hawk helicopter. It's just been a great life for me. And my life is changed now, and it's going to be different forever now, but I don't resent that. And a lot of people have asked me that. Well, do you have any animosity since your injuries? And I don't. It's just a different phase of my life. And, you know, God has a great plan for me. And I'm not sure what it is right now, but I'm going to find out. I'm looking forward to the next step.
Okay, we're going to go find some better fishing grounds.
Okay.
I'm going to move this.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my name's Clint Douglas. I was a staff sergeant on a Special Forces A team in 2nd Battalion, 20th Special Forces Group, Illinois National Guard. This is based on a journal entry I wrote after we had a very bizarre meeting with an Afghan warlord in this castle that he had occupied. The name of the essay is Lunch with Pirates. Ziauddin was a bandit and a thug, and so, of course, he had been a close American ally. Although a Pashtun, he had been a member in the Tajik-dominated Northern Alliance. As a young man, he had fought against the Soviets during the jihad and then against the Taliban, who had imprisoned and tortured him for several years. When the Americans invaded, he joined the swelling ranks of unemployed warlords and re-emerged from obscurity to fight the Taliban once again. By all accounts, he had been a brave and tenacious fighter, but he was now a petty warlord beholden to no one, and his rank of general was recognized due to his years of fealty and service against the Taliban. His men had terrorized the community, demanding protection money from the local shop owners and raping young boys on their way to school. They were highwaymen who set up illegal checkpoints, charging road taxes from anyone unlucky enough to stumble upon one of their roadblocks. And they preyed on the local nomads, kidnapping prominent tribal elders until their families ransomed them from jail. Audin and his men had gone out of their way to alienate and piss off everyone in town. Rocketing our firebase didn't endear him to us either. Now, I had never in my pitiful life knowingly exchanged pleasantries over lunch, or any other meal for that matter, with a man who was regularly trying to kill me. But when Bill invited me to escort him up to the castle for his first meeting with Audin, I jumped at the opportunity. The idea seemed so elegant, like the medieval Spaniards and Moors retiring to each other's tents to play chess and exchange bon mots after a bloody day of battle and slaughter. So, moving on, we're at the lunch. Things have already started to go badly. And this is my team sergeant, Bill, speaking. Well, General, the only way that we'll be able to help you is if you join your forces with the Afghan National Army, Bill continued. He didn't have to threaten. He was a threat. Son of Norwegian farmers from Minnesota, he looked every bit the errant Viking that he was. His thick and muscled body always seemed to be straining to contain something explosive and volatile. His face was permanently locked in an angry scowl under a shaggy mane of sandy hair. I'd always had a nagging sense that Bill might feel the need to snap my neck someday, just to relieve tension, and I'd been his friend for 6 years. All right, so the luncheon is already finished. The results are ambiguous at best. So we're back in our firebase, and we've gotten out of the vehicles, removed our body armor, and we've headed over to the Afghan officer tent to discuss basically our impressions with our Afghan counterparts. The general consensus among the Afghans was that Audin needed to be handled respectfully, if not gently. While all this flowery discussion was taking place, I noticed that Bill seemed more explosive than usual, and then suddenly, he slammed his fist onto the table, spilling everyone's tea, and his face contorted into unmasked fury. I hate that asshole, he screamed to no one in particular. I wanted to punch that no good in the face, beat that right in his own goddamn house, beat him right in front of his men. I'd love to shoot that bastard. And then he laughed like a maniac at his own bloody fantasy. Cultures everywhere celebrate their traditions, but they also chafe against them. Most Afghans were tired. Tired of war, tired of fighting, and tired of meaningless talk. Bill embodied the unrestrained and unpredictable power of the United States. But his frustrated rage appeared to be honest, and honesty is a rare and precious thing. Stories of his impolitic explosion filtered through the Terps, the ANA soldiers, the Afghan militias and mercenaries, into the city, and no doubt to our myriad enemies. Bill's reputation was made. That was the day that the Afghans named Bill Shere Khan, the Tiger. That was the day that the Afghans fell in love with him. Bill was a force of nature, and so it was impossible to tell whether his outburst was genuine or calculated drama, but it amounted to an earthquake. Here was Bill, heir to Iskander, in all of his blonde, barbarous glory, equal parts courteous and cruel. Up until that moment, the Audin situation was a local political problem, but Bill had made it personal. He'd made it tribal. And at that moment, he'd crossed over and gone native. After that day, there wasn't a thing that our Afghan troops wouldn't do for him. They trusted him completely. In a land fragmented by blood feuds, he transcended politics and had declared a personal vendetta. And in Afghanistan, it was considered a moral obligation to carry out one's revenge. 2 weeks later, Ziauddin quietly abandoned Castle Grayskull and fled to Kabul.
Sergeant Clint Douglas of the NEA writing project Operation Homecoming, guitar by Jess Atkins. This next vet also fought in Afghanistan. He's an Iraqi and former Taliban, captured by the Northern Alliance and held for a week with hundreds of others in a warlord's basement. Ali Abdul Matar was recorded by Scott Carrier near Mazar in November 2001. When you hear him say,
"Bled,"
that's blood.
It's very problem that's 1 week, right? Somebody is die beside you, and somebody it can't move, you won't help, please help me, everybody, my blade is out from my body. I tell him, what I help you? I can't move because I'm hungry, because I want water. I can't move, and I can't go outside because some fire. All right, and I don't want die. I don't want die because my work, I tell you, all is over. I don't want die to Taliban. And 1 week, everybody inside, not eat anything, and drink some water, water and blood. Because somebody inside die. Blood and water. All right, it's not good. And you want anything to mouth, all right? You want anything for this time. And not any light. You can see something and fire for sky. All right, and Ireland's and tank, and you can listen anything only to do all of this. All right, and you see friend is die, this die, this die, this die. Now I don't want to come back to Iraq. I don't want to come back to any earth Arab. I want to go to America. I want to complete my life. I want to go to Europe. Because my family, it's need me. My family, it's need help. All right? I don't want this work. This work is very dangerous. I want to tell Office of United Nations, maybe help me for this subject. I don't want to come back to Iraq. And I don't want to go to any earth Arab, please. I want to complete my life. I want to complete my school. That's my dream. All right?
This is the best way to put this. What got me through Iraq was I had convinced myself that I was definitely going to die. I was definitely not going to make it. That kind of freed me a little bit. And I realized that as long as I kind of had nothing to lose in that sense, then I was free. My name is Matthew Richard McHugh. My job started out as rifleman, and then I was promoted to team leader. The only thing I wanted to be in the world was a sergeant. Couldn't imagine being anything else. I'd have dreams about it. I imagined being a soldier forever. My squad was the night patrol squad. We would do an 8-hour patrol, and sometimes we would patrol till the sun came up. We would be in a kind of circle facing this market, looking at these farmers' markets, you know, and it was really incredible to see how much power farmers really have. And that was like a big lesson for me, that when everything else breaks down, the farmers really hold society together. I definitely saw how powerful the farmers were, more powerful than any other piece of infrastructure, more powerful than the police. And so I really started seeing value in agriculture. But so eventually I came back from Iraq, and I was very shook. Shook up. And I had to train these soldiers under me, these new soldiers. And I was so affected by the situation that I think in a way, I mean, that I was definitely going crazy. I really was going nuts. We'd go on a field problem, go do this, and then I would listen to these like peace albums by A Perfect Circle.
As I walk on through this wicked world, searching for light in the darkness of insanity.
And I decided it was time to leave the army. There's something else going on.
What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding?
And that's when I looked up sustainable agriculture.
What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding?
Yeah, so, other than the corn, which is really kind of getting a little too... The corn is getting a little bit more like corn, like... You know, real corn.
We are at the French Garden Farm outside of Sebastopol, California.
We probably won't plant here next year. It's just too much. I can't manage all this. but I'm really happy with these eggplants. Jeez, man, these things are rocking. They are rocking.
My favorite vegetables, rainbow carrots. I like chard. Definitely like harvesting onions because they're kind of your pride, you know. And potatoes. Absolutely enjoy potatoes. I'll do tons of potatoes next year. Farming is everything. You have to, just like soldiering, 24 hours a day, you don't stop. You are on the job all the time. You're always thinking about it. It just becomes a part of you. I tell people that I was from New Mexico, but then I tell people that I spent time in Iraq, and I'm no longer from New Mexico. I'm a person who's from war. And I think some people look at me as being from hell. I'm no longer afraid of Iraq, maybe the way I was. I think for a while I went through a time when I was simply afraid of the place. Now I do want to go back, but not as a soldier. I'd like to go back as a farmer. I still want to contribute to our society. I still want to make a world a better place. And I understand that having the power of soil is the most incredible thing on earth. Because you have that. You have the power to grow things. In a sense, you don't have any power really personally because life does what it does. But you put yourself in an opportunity to have the soil give you something. I think that I can do the world a lot more good with a shovel and the things that I've learned than I can with an M16.
Matthew McHugh works now with the Farmer Veteran Coalition, farmvetco.org. Alex Blair produced that story for the Speakeasy DC Storycast. The music is A Perfect Circle. What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? You are hearing voices of veterans. Next, testimony by soldiers and Marines at the hearings of the Iraq Veterans Against the War. You may not agree with what they have to say, but you got to admit, they've earned the right to say it.
On April 18th, 2006, I had my first confirmed kill. This man was innocent. I don't know his name. He was walking back to his house, and I shot him in front of his friend and his father. The first round didn't kill him after I had hit him up here in his neck area. Afterwards, he started screaming and looked right into my eyes. So I took another shot and took him out. We were all congratulated after we had our first kills. My company commander personally congratulated me. This is the same individual who had stated that whoever gets their first kill by stabbing them to death will get a 4-day pass when we return from Iraq. One day, the battalion JAG officer, who's basically our battalion legal counsel, he pulled us all together, made sure the embedded reporters weren't there with us at the time, and proceeded to basically give us what was going to be a rules of engagement brief for Fallujah. Basically, we were going to be operating under the assumption that everyone was hostile. He sort of wrapped up the brief by sort of going, okay, Marines, you see an individual with a weapon, what do? Kill him. You see an individual with a pair of binoculars, what do? Kill him. You see an individual with a cell phone out, kill him. You see an individual who maybe not carrying anything or displaying any specific hostile action or intent, running from, say, one building to another, running across the street, or even running away from you, assume that he is maneuvering against you, and kill him.
When they kicked in the door of this house, what they found was they hit three people inside the wedding party. One of them was an adult man who was, you know, slightly wounded. Another young girl, maybe 10, was slightly wounded. But what really got me was there was another girl who was maybe 6 or 7, and she was dead. She had been shot by a bunch of, you know, teenage American kids.
My first mission was a ride with the unit that we were replacing. We had half of our men and half of their men go out, and they got to show us the sector that we were going to operate in for the next year. At the time, there was a curfew in operation where Iraqis were not supposed to be outside of their houses after dark. We rolled around our sector, and eventually we came upon two men that were in the field. They're out after curfew, and they're not U.S. military or coalition forces. The men on the gun proceeded to open fire on these men, killing both of them where they stood. Mark 19, fully automated, belt-fed grenade launchers, where you hold the butterfly down and grenades fly out the other end. Once we got to these men, they were blown into pieces. There was no sign of any sort of weapons, any sort of anything upon them. I was told by the sergeant that we were replacing that these men were out in their fields farming, because the periodic electricity, the pumps that irrigated their fields only operated while they had electricity, which meant to farm their fields, sometimes they had to go out into the dark, knowingly risking the curfew to farm their fields. I asked the sergeant, why did he fire upon these men if he knew that they were farming in their field? And he told me because they were out after curfew. The men I served with were honorable soldiers. They were professionals. They went to Iraq hoping to do good, hoping to do right. They went to Iraq to defend their country, to defend their neighbors, and defend their citizens. However, we found rapidly that that was not the case. In the massive confusion, it's almost startling how little control you have and how much fear perpetuates you to not really concern yourself with things like rules of engagement and Geneva Conventions.
This man right here was my third confirmed kill. As you can see, he was riding his bicycle. His body was dragged about 10 feet to the right of him, where his body was thrown behind a rock wall and his bicycle was thrown on top of him. Later on in the day, we went ahead. We had CBS Laura Logan with us, but she was with the other squad, and so she wasn't with us. So myself and two other people went ahead and took out some individuals because we were excited about the firefight we had just gone into, and we didn't have a cameraman or woman with us. Anytime we did have embedded reporters with us, our actions would change drastically. We never acted the same. We were always on key with everything, did everything by the books. A lot of the raids and patrols we did were at the night, around 3 o'clock in the morning, around there. And what we would do is just kick in the doors and terrorize the families. If the men of the household were giving us problems, we'd go ahead and take care of them any way we felt necessary, whether it be choking them or slamming their head against the walls. On my wrist, there is Arabic for F you. I got that put on my wrist just 2 weeks before we went to Iraq because that was my choking hand. And anytime I felt the need to take out aggression, I would go ahead and use it. With that being said, that is my testimony. I just want to say that I am sorry for the hate and destruction that I have inflicted on innocent people. And I'm sorry for the hate and destruction that others have inflicted on innocent people. And that until people hear about what is going on with this war, it will continue to happen and people will continue to die. I am sorry for the things that I did. I am no longer the monster that I once was. Thank you.
Another time that I was out on patrol in the Kendi Street area, as I said, part of our mission was to meet and greet the local population and find out what their problems were. And so I approached a man with my interpreter on the side of the road, and I asked him, I said, look, are your lives better because we're here? Are you safer? Do you feel more secure? Do you feel like we are liberating you? And that man looked at me straight in the eye, and he said, mister, we Iraqis know that you have good intentions here. But the fact of the matter is, before America invaded, we didn't have to worry about car bombs in our neighborhoods. We didn't have to worry about the safety of our own children as they walk to school. And we didn't have to worry about U.S. soldiers shooting at us as we drive up and down our own streets.
And at night, American soldiers are rolling around your streets telling you that you can't go outside and you can't talk to your friends, you can't enjoy yourself. You can't gather outside the coffee house or the chai shop, because if you go out past dark, you're committing a crime. So essentially, during the summer months, Sadr City was a prison. 3.2 million people in Sadr City were prisoners of war. I was a great soldier once upon a time. And now I stand here to fight for my brothers more than I ever could while I wore a uniform.
Iraq Veterans Against the War are at IVAW.org. Winter Soldier's testimony was by former Marines John Turner and Michael LeDuc, and former soldiers Clifton Hicks, Garrett Reppenhagen, Jason Hurd, and Christopher Sean Goldsmith. Music by Jeff Arnston.
When I was in Iraq, I often found myself reflecting on the history of the Peloponnesian War, especially as regards the kind of polarizations in our own country. But I also thought about this in relation to the Shia and the Sunni in Iraq. Basically, any time you have crucial decisions that are being made in which two sides vilify each other.
Sergeant Helen Gearhart of Operation Homecoming.
This was written by Thucydides. It's the history of the Peloponnesian War. He was an Athenian general. He lived between 460 and 400 BC. To fit in with the change of events, words too had to change their usual meanings. What used to be described as a thoughtless act of aggression was now regarded as the courage one would expect to find in a party member. To think of the future and wait was merely another way of saying one was a coward. Any idea of moderation was just an attempt to disguise one's unmanly character. Ability to understand a question from all sides meant that one was totally unfitted for action. If an opponent made a reasonable speech, the party in power, so far from giving it a generous reception, took every precaution to see that it had no practical effect. Love of power, operating through greed and through personal ambition, was the cause of all these evils. To this must be added the violent fanaticism which came into play once the struggle had broken out.
The NEA's writing project for veterans is at OperationHomecoming.net, and Fly Fishing for Wounded Soldiers is ProjectHealingWaters.org. I'm Barrett Golding, and all these links are at HearingVoices.com.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darum. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of soundimagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is hearingvoices.com.